Hi, I'm Molly, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hello, Molly.
Welcome to everyone. Thanks for coming. Kind of nervous. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. My sobriety date is February 14th, 2013, and, Valentine's Day. And I have a sponsor, and I work the steps with her regularly. If you take anything away from this, get a sponsor and work the steps. So growing up, thinking back to, now that I'm sober and, reflecting on how I grew up and what it was like, I noted, I heard someone talk about this in a meeting, and I could totally relate. I was, hyper aware of myself, and that I was more aware of myself than other people were of them. I was very anxious and stressed out as a kid. I remember somebody saying, I wish I could be a kid, to go back and it being carefree. And then I got really anxious because, I was I'm not carefree. And I was, doing childhood wrong. just to give you, that. That's pretty common. I grew up around alcohol, and it was super common. I grew up in a small town. And my family drank. It was easy. I saw adults drunk all the time and kids drunk. I come from a family in a town where, we have the basement stock full of the bar with all the alcohol, and then we have the upstairs liquor cabinet, and then we have the liquor that you're currently drinking on the counter, the garage full of beer, and then literally cases of alcohol next to the canned food. In the back basement, just in case. So I just knew I would grow up drinking, and that wasn't going to be a big deal. My first drink, I drank to get drunk, and I loved it. I all of a sudden was not so scared. I was very concerned with just people liking me and that other people were happy, because if you were happy, there was a better chance that you liked me. And the first drink, I just got totally blacked out, and I loved it. It was, end of eighth grade. So then I pretty much tried to drink as much as I could. It was, pretty easy, but I also was, a pretty goody-two-shoes, so I didn't want to get in too much trouble. Also, heads up, there's also drugs in my story and, outside issues. I know. To me, it's important to talk about it because it's part of my story, and I know that those continue to play a role in my life, and it's not just alcohol. Anyway, so it was experimenting, kind of running with the wrong crowd, but then I got a boyfriend in high school, and he was super straight edge, and he was you shouldn't drink or do drugs, and I was do you love me? And he's yeah. I was cool, I won't either. So I was straight edge until college. But in the meantime, I still didn't develop any good coping skills. So I actually developed a pretty serious eating disorder up until college, and that just plays a role in my response to the world is self-centered fear. And that manifests in different ways. So once I got to college, it was all of a sudden it was a whole new world. Broke up with that boyfriend in a month, and then I was drinking. And I guess I was pretty functioning for a while. Also, I went to a big college, so it was easy to find people who wanted to drink and use like me. So I don't know, drinking what it was binge drinking. I also started, I say this because I started to get help for my eating disorder. And I'm really grateful for that because later on in my story, I had people who cared about me and knew, there was a part of me inside that had the practice of asking for help and doing, taking suggestions. So school didn't go the linear four-year route. There's a lot of letters on my transcript, withdrawn and complete. So I went through anxiety, panic attacks and depression. And I was just drinking and using the whole time. And every time I used, it just was not to feel. And when I drank, I wasn't like ever angry and I didn't get in fights, but I ended up would like end up hurting myself. Like I'm a risk taker, so I would like get drunk and I wanted to like climb everything. And I would like fall off and hurt myself. And it just, there was so many times thinking back that like I was like, okay, I'm just like, it's gonna be chill. Or I'm like gonna go to a wine and cheese thing and it's gonna be super classy, and it just never was. And it was like wine and cheese, and then someone's like shots. I'm like, fuck yeah. Cause like I just wanted to like have all the fun all the time and like fuck it. And that's just, and to me it was just like, that was when I was most comfortable. And blacking out was totally normal. And so, but it came to a point where people around me like asked, like, are you having fun? Cause like, we're not like taking care of you. We're not having fun. So I was like, okay, maybe I'll just smoke weed. And that was pretty chill. I just, you know, like it was safer, for me. And then that's when I felt like I really got an identity. And again, I was functioning. Like I was, you know, I had friends, and sometimes I passed classes, sometimes I didn't. I was really good at manipulating people. So I would, like, just tell my professors about my eating disorder and, like, that my little brother had passed away in high school and, like, all this stuff. And I would get, like, extensions, or they would, like, pass me because they saw potential. And I was so nice. And I remember my first sponsor telling me, like, you're manipulative. And I was like, what? I was like, me? Like, no, like I'm so open. And they're like, nah, like, and then is it five? Oh, I knew this was going to happen. So basically my life got smaller and smaller because all I wanted to do was get high. I gave up friendships. I was barely holding my job. I passed up promotions, and I just, and I was starting to fail out of school, and I just told, like, I told my parents, like, I'm gonna smoke weed for the rest of my life, like, every day, and they, like, and I was just, like, that's just who I am, and, you know, they would be, like, what about a job, and I was, like, I'm never gonna have a job that won't let me smoke weed every single day, and it's, like, I just had created such a small world around drugs and alcohol. And it was like this moment when my boyfriend at the time, like, he was the person I loved the most in my life. He was like, I've shared this before. He said, like, I don't want to have another night of just sitting, like, watch you smoke weed on the couch. I was like, well, you should go home then. Cause like, that's what I'm doing. But, and then he walked out of the door, and then all of us, that was like, if there was ever a hot, I was like, fuck, like, what am I doing? And I had been working with this therapist for my eating disorder for a while, and she actually suggested going to Marijuana Anonymous. That was my first 12-step meeting. And I remember walking in, and they read this list of 12 questions of, like, you might have an issue. And it was just like, yes, 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 yes. And it was like, do you ever smoke weed alone? Have you ever, like, failed to make promises about, like, cutting back? Does it affect your, like, memory, motivation, concentration? Do you cope with your feelings? Like, all that. I was just like, fuck. And part of me though was like, there was a little bit of a relief because I was like, this is it, like I'm an addict. And that was in December, and I was there's only one Marijuana Anonymous meeting a week in Ann Arbor. That's where I got sober. And someone from, also, I was like, I'm 22, I don't want to have a lame life, like I don't want to get sober. What about my wedding, you know, and, like, all this stuff? Like, I need to drink. So I'm just so grateful that there was someone in those rooms who heard me share about being a student, and they got me plugged in with the Collegiate Recovery Program at University of Michigan, and I met, like, awesome people there. And it was meeting other people who were, like, young and fun and people who, like, I thought would be cool, and, like, they were sober. Like, that was huge for me and relating. And they suggested go to AA. I was like, I don't think I have a problem with alcohol. But this was where, like, people-pleasing really came in because I just, like, did what they told me to do. And so, yeah, I just, like, was like, okay, I'm going to go to meetings. And got a sponsor, and took the suggestion. So, and yeah, it was like kind of exciting too, cause I'm pretty like friendly. And so it was like cool to meet new people. But it was hard because I mean, it was like, there just was so many times where it was like, I didn't want to use and I did. And it wasn't really until I actually moved out of the house I was living in. And like, that was the biggest suggestion I took. I moved into a transitional house. And so I had to go to 9 meetings a week. I had a curfew. I had drug tests, house meetings. And that when you hear like get in the middle of AA, like it just like forced me. And I'm so grateful. And it's in these rooms that I've learned to do really hard things where normally like my natural reaction is to like actually like cry underneath the table for anything good, bad. Like I'm just like full of self-centered fear. And it was meeting women in particularly that just like loved and supported me that I was able to take time off of school, get a foundation of working the steps, coming to know a higher power, being of service, and like just doing things that were humbling. That's been huge too. So like, and like going back to school, and I've been able to like do all of these things, like really hard life things that somehow I didn't get the like handbook of how to do. And it makes no sense. Like we have these 12 steps and like, to me, I don't understand how the 12 steps helped me finish my degree, like write papers, helped me, like set boundaries with my parents, be a good friend, like admit and make amends when I'm wrong, and then like move across the country and be so uncomfortable. Like I moved in August and sometimes it's just like my skin's crawling and like immediately I either want to go back to like eating disorder stuff or I just want to isolate and like everyone's weird or whatever. But like it's just so cool that I just like keep coming back to meetings and it's okay that I'm uncomfortable and I'm just so grateful because it was never okay to be uncomfortable. I didn't want to feel anything. So I feel like, is that 1 minute? Okay. So yeah, I'm thankful. And you know, recently, as far as like what's been going on today, yeah, I moved in August. And you know, I used to like, there was moments where I had, like all of a sudden could like physically feel my higher power. Like I felt sound. And moving here, there was times where I felt nothing. I felt like I was praying to a brick wall. And that's really scary. And you hear about people who have time and they go out and like, that scares me more now than when I was like in really early sobriety. So I'm just so grateful that no matter where we go, we have it. And if you just like keep coming back and you just like work with a sponsor and work the steps and pray, no matter if you believe it, no matter if you can feel it, I've heard this before, like it's gonna be okay because it already is. And I've also heard too, like, from friends, and I really love this, like no matter like how shitty my day is today, like my worst day sober is nothing compared to like my worst day using. So yeah, that's all I have. Thanks.
Do I have time to get like a glass of water?
I'll get you a glass of water.
Thanks.
You want some coffee?
Oh, coffee, please. I don't know if I need this. Can everybody hear me?
Yeah.
Use it. Okay. Use it.
Use it. All right.
We're recording.
Oh, we're recording. Wow. Like the old commercial goes, can you hear me now? Hi, my name is Sam. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Sam.
I'm really glad to be here. It pays to tell you how I came to arrive here. Facebook. I've got an 18-year-old son, so you're not much older than my kid. And you know, I wish I had your level of, and I know it's no crosstalk, but you know, what the hell. I wish I had your level of insight back when I was your age, because I sure didn't. But anyway, so I ran into an old high school buddy, and we weren't even in the same high school together. We knew each other. We went to different high schools. And over Facebook. Now, my 18-year-old won't be on Facebook anymore because he says his old guys have taken it over. And it's true. And so, you know, I celebrated 15 years on May 15th. My sobriety date is May 15th, 2001. And announced that on Facebook. And because my recovery, as you'll find out, is actually very public, and that's kind of weird for me. But and my friend reached out to me and says, "Hey, I'm sober too." And of course, then we met for coffee, and you know, then we had to talk about how long sober we were, because you know the AA rules: the guy with the most clean time is your boss. So turns out he's 19 years sober, so he wins. And since then, he's been assigning me to come to different AA meetings, and that's wonderful. Thank you so much. That's wonderful for me, because my normal fellowship for the past 13 years has been the other bar, which is a group of recovering lawyers. It's kind of like AA, but it's not strictly AA. And so I've actually been going to more AA meetings in the past few months than I have in the past several years, which is nice. Now, I go to two other bar meetings every week. It's the same fellowship. They meet in the same place twice a week, and that's really wonderful. But now let's get into what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. So what it was like, I grew up in a wonderful life. I grew up in San Leandro, California, just right over there, with an intact family, a mother, father, a brother, two dogs, and several cats, and went to Catholic school, and everything was great. My parents were great. My life was great. Everything was great. Great, 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 great. You know, I felt, you know, the same kind of, you know, loneliness and isolation that every kid, I guess, feels. It was funny. The first high school reunion I ever attended was my 30th in 2012. And we all got around. And the nice thing about being around 50 years old is you lose all the bullshit. You know, you're no longer competing. Who had kids first? Who got married first? Who went to what college? Who's got what kind of job? Now the competition is who's got hair. And so we all sat around, and we all realized we all felt the same way during high school. We all thought that the guy next to us was so much cooler than us. And we didn't realize that that poor man or woman, young man or woman, was going through the same crap that we went through and looking at me and thinking, man, that guy's got it all together. It was crazy. I had my first drink that I can remember when I was 11. I was out cutting wood with my old man, and he had a six-pack of Olympia beer. And my parents were very young parents. They had me right out of high school. And so he was kind of liberal-minded, and so you know, he handed his 11-year-old a beer. And I loved it. It was great. It was Olympia, made in Tumwater, Washington. And it was delicious. And I had four of them. And I was still on my feet. What I didn't realize, neither of my parents were alcoholics, but, and what I didn't realize at the time is that, you know, despite the fact that neither of them were alcoholics, I've got it on both sides of my family. My mother's family is littered with dead and incarcerated people because of alcohol and drugs. My father's side of the family is equally littered with dead and incarcerated and recovering people for the same reason. And we got the whole shebang with us. I occasionally drank as a kid. I never partied really in high school. I was kind of to myself. Here's the weird thing. When I was 19, I moved out of my parents' house. The day after I moved out, I became a six-pack-a-day drinker and a pack-a-day smoker. It was literally overnight. I do not know why. I've looked at it, wondered, thought about it. I used to really care about this in early sobriety, and my first sponsor looked at me and said, "Sam, you know, figuring out why you're an alcoholic is the booby prize of sobriety, because at the end of the day, you're not going to change. That's not, finding out why isn't going to change the fact that you're an alcoholic now. And finding out why isn't going to give you the solution now. You got to learn to live sober as a recovering alcoholic." And that made a lot of sense to me. So I don't have an explanation as I stand here before you today. So I'm in college. I drank like hell. I learned very quickly to drink a lot ahead of time before I went to functions where there was going to be drinking, so that I could drink like the people around me and not stand out. So I would drink half pint of bourbon or, you know, a couple, three beers before I went out with my buddies, so that I would look and sound just like them when we were out. Crazy? Yeah, but true. I went through college without a problem. I mean, a lot of the reason that I didn't bottom out any, you know, as you know, early as I probably should have is, you know, I'm a, you know, decent-looking white male in Northern California. I caught a lot of breaks. A lot of people gave me a lot of breaks and let me out of a lot of jams just literally because of the way I looked and sounded. And, you know, that's just a fact of my life. I went to law school. I learned really quickly that I didn't have to attend class. Now the State Bar makes you attend class. Back in the day, they didn't. But now they take roll, and the teachers have to turn in the dean. Dean's got to turn in the State Bar, and the State Bar controls your accreditation. Back then, nobody cared. The thing that changed in law school for me, though, was that I stopped being ashamed of my drinking, and I learned to be not ashamed of my drinking because I met my buddy Bill. Ironically enough, his name was Bill. Bill grew up in San Leandro just like I did, although I went to Catholic school and he went to San Leandro High. He went to public school. By the way, my favorite Catholic school memory, eighth grade, I was applying to get into Bishop O'Dowd High School, and Sister Ramona, God bless it, she had my number, pulled me aside during recess, grabbed me hard by the arm and said, "I hope you never get into Bishop O'Dowd. That's a wonderful school, and you're the most dishonest, lying little kid I've ever met in my life. You don't deserve to go." I got in, I waved the admissions letter in front of her face one day, and then she's probably still alive. So in law school, Bill drank like I did. And oh, by the way, where's Bill now? Well, Bill lost his law license like I did. But the last time I saw Bill, he was demented in a hospital bed over there in Eden Hospital in Hayward. Because he's not supposed to be drinking, and he had like a fifth of vodka and damn near exploded his liver. And we didn't expect him to live through that, and once you know it, he lived. I mean, we're persistent, you know, we're a persistent lot, aren't we? But anyway, Bill drank like I did, but he wasn't ashamed of it. He wore it like a badge of honor, and I glommed on to him. I wanted what Bill had. I did. I immediately liked the music that Bill liked. I read the books that Bill read. I assumed the mannerisms that Bill had. He had a pair of cowboy boots. I had a pair of cowboy boots. All right? I was this guy's crony. And he was good to me, too. I mean, we had a lot of fun. We closed down a lot of places. We were gadflies. Took the State Bar, drunk, passed it, easiest test I ever took in my life. God protects children and drunks. Bill passed it a second time, but we wound up working across the street from each other in downtown San Francisco. And this was in days before cell phones and internet and all that newfangled stuff that you guys all take for granted. So at 11 o'clock every morning, Bill and I, you know, one of us would call the other up, and we'd go to a bar, which is now gone, called the Stagecoach, which is at the bottom of the Wells Fargo building, the basement of the Wells Fargo building, in Montgomery Market. We had the same waitress every time, Aileen. She was great. And she saw us walking in. Before we sat down, she had our drinks in front of us. And we'd stay there, and we would drink until about 5:30. Then I'd come back to the office. Where were you, Sam? I was at the law library. Now, there were no cell phones back then. There was no sending me a text message. "Hey, buddy, how's that research coming?" You know, there were no computers. You know, I had to actually crack books to do research, and the only place you could do that was at the law library. So there were always a bunch of people there. It was cavernous. Nobody could find you. It was the perfect dodge. The funny thing about that law job was this. I lasted there, I think, about 6 months. And at the end of like 5 months, well, it was actually close to 6 months, I got really angry. And the reason I got angry was because my contract said I was supposed to get a raise, and I just got my paycheck and there was no raise. I just got my normal paycheck, and those bastards were trying to cheat me. So I went up to Bill Dillingham's office, and that's AA coffee. That's delicious. So I went up to Bill Dillingham's office, and I vented my spleen. I cursed him out. And he looked at me and said, "Sam, come with me." And he's a big guy. He puts his arm around me, takes me to my office, you know, which kind of recognized it. And he said, "Look around. How much work do you see in here?" There wasn't any. "How many meetings have you been to in the past 90 days? I hadn't been to any. He said, "Look, Sam, we're old school lawyers. It looks bad if we fire one of our own associates. I mean, the word gets out on the street that we made a mistake. that we misjudge somebody. I mean, we look like idiots to these people. They will come after us. We'll never settle another case in this town again if we fire you, because we will have made a mistake in hiring you. But we figured if we gave you no work, you would be ashamed of yourself enough to just quit, do the right thing, and leave. And to our amazement, you've hung around. So I told him to go piss up a rope. I quit. I don't need to take this from you or anybody else. And I opened my own practice in my hometown, San Leandro, California. Now, if you go to Matter of Bellaccini, and that's my last name, Bellaccini, at 4 Cal State Bar Court Reporter, page 883, you will find out what happened to me next. I was admitted in 91. By 92, I had opened my own practice. By 93, I was disbarred. I used to think I was the youngest guy in the state to get disbarred, but some bastard took that record away from me about 6 years ago. I mean, he was literally 2 years out and he got disbarred. And, I hate him for that. But I had a record. I was in Guinness. But I wound up staying with my parents. You know, it was a very low point in my life. I had a state bar investigator who visited their house in Oakland dutifully every Tuesday, knocked on the door for half an hour, asked me to come out and talk to him. I finally went to his office over at 1441 Franklin Street in San Francisco, and the minute I walked into his office, the door slammed shut, a prosecutor appeared out of nowhere, big hands, sat me down in a chair, put a resignation in front of me, and the investigator looked at me, did me a big favor, did all of you a favor too, and he said, "You're not leaving this room until you sign this." And it was basically a stipulated disbarment. And I knew I had to sign it. I had stolen money. I had lied to judges. I had lied to clients. I breached my oath. You know, I took an oath. And I knew that I had breached it. And I knew that basically my time was up. So I signed it and I walked out without a law license. I was heartbroken. My parents thought I was just depressed, so they sent me to a shrink. And the shrink prescribed, I forget what the popular antidepressant was at the time, but he prescribes this antidepressant for me. I did not take it, because this is typical of me during my drinking time. I actually read the label on the medication. It says, "This may kill you if you drink." And I'm like, "Well, fuck that. I'm drinking." So that lasted a little while, and my parents got more and more frustrated with me. They eventually got to the point where, you know, they paid for me to live elsewhere because they didn't want me living with them. And the first kind of change in all this is when I met my wife, Elaine. She was a temp agent for a temporary agency in downtown San Francisco, and she got me work. I glommed onto her like you wouldn't believe, and it turns out she was just a raging codependent. We were meant for each other. She found me places to work. When we started dating, she found me places to live. Eventually, she got me the illegal in-law in the basement of the flat that she was renting up above with two other women. Then we got pregnant and got married. And we had to find an apartment, so we found this apartment. And the night before we moved out is a good story. That's really good. That just shows you what kind of drunk I was. So I got paid. I got like a $300 paycheck. And so I take the BART over here, and I love being around here because it didn't clue in immediately where I was. But I used to, when I was going to Cal Berkeley as an undergraduate, I used to live in an apartment over at 55th and San Pablo. And there's a casino down the way. There. So the night before we were supposed to move out, I went to the casino because I was going to double, triple my money. I was going to do really great. Now, here's what I don't remember about the night. I had poker chips in front of me and cards. You could smoke in the casino back then. So I had a cigarette in one hand and a drink in the other. I don't know how I played my hand because both hands were occupied at all times. But eventually, it took me all night to lose that $300, but I did. And I stiffed a cab driver, and golly, if you're out there, come talk to me. I owe you $40. But I stiffed a cab driver to get back to San Francisco, and I come waltzing up to our old flat to get moved out about 9:30, and our friends were supposed to show up at about 8. to move us out. And certainly they did show up. And basically they had taken all my stuff out of the little rat hole that I was living in and put it in garbage bags. And were loading it in a truck. My wife was several months pregnant at the time, newly married, and just heartbroken. You know, not only did she not know where I was all night, not only was I not there when, you know, her friends, I didn't really have friends at that point, showed up to move us out, but I was drunk out of my mind and broke. And I was mad at her. I was mad at her because she made a scene in front of her friends and made me look bad. That's the kind of drunk I was. We went through a little dance over the next couple, 3 years, where I got jobs and lost jobs. After the birth of our son, you know, Elaine was working three jobs at one point just to keep us going. And I was home, you know, I was about up to a quart of bourbon every morning. The first pint went down fast. I got to enjoy the second pint, you know, a lot. And, you know, things happened. The woman who ran our daycare forbade me to ever come pick up our son again because too many of the parents complained about how drunk I was when I showed up. It was bad. So what happened? My wife got into recovery for codependency and made what I will call a credible threat to leave. And this was on May 14th, 2001. And I believed her. She said, if you're not in this rehab, and she pointed to Kaiser Chemical Dependency Recovery Program in San Francisco, she said, it's good coffee. She said, if you're not in there tomorrow, I'm taking our son and the clothes on our back and I'm leaving. Whatever possessions we have in this, you know, apartment are yours. The lease is yours. The car is yours. Whatever little money we've got in the bank, yours. I'm leaving with our kid. And you'll never see us again. I will make sure of it. You know, I'll move out of state, and I'll make sure that you never, ever see me, and you never, ever see your son again. And I wish I could tell you that, oh, I went, oh, my God, my lovely boy, my beautiful wife, but no. I believed her, and so I knew that my meal ticket was walking out of the door. And I couldn't afford to have that happen. I wasn't doing anything better anyway. And I'd been able to go through periods of my life where I could stretch, put together a couple weeks sobriety to keep her happy, keep somebody happy. So I figured I'd do this CDRP thing and you know, cool my old lady off, as it were. And everything would come back to normal again. Everything would be fine. So I got into therapy, and for the first 60 days, I was the worst of the worst in there. I'd sit there in group and point to everybody and go, you're an idiot, 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 you're an idiot. I'm like Sinatra, you know, I can hold my liquor. You know, the rest of you are idiots. And they, fun story, Kate Riley was my therapist, and she was also the director of that place at the time. You know, 4 foot nothing, black Irish, and it turns out just evil is all get out. And it was me and five other guys that she personally took care of. And the reason being is because on intake it was determined we were the ones who were going to die. And she didn't want her very young staff to be saddled with a fatality. And so it was me and five other guys, and we were just, I mean, you know, we were the ones who were going to die. Die. I mean, that was on, that's on my chart. He's going to die. And so Kate took care of me. So I go through 60 days of this, and here's what happened. I love this, and this is absolutely true, which I have to say because this gets into later. My wife goes, it's like 4th of July weekend of 2001. She's going to Chicago with the boy to visit her parents, and I'm home alone with a few bucks in my pocket. I've got some jewelry in the jewelry box that I still have, and I'm picking that up. I'm going to go to the pawn shop. There are a couple clubs I'm going to go to. I'm going to get loaded, okay? And it's like an out-of-body experience for me. I swear to God, it's like watching myself in some God-blessed movie. It was the most horrible thing in the world because I had this clean time. It was 70 days or something like that. You know, I was on my way to quitting smoking. I was almost at my quit date. And I haven't had a cigarette in 15 years, thank you very much. And, you know, I honestly did not want to drink. You know, and I'd always thought I had control. You know, I always thought that I could not drink if I told myself not to drink. And all the times that I drank when I didn't want to, well, I secretly wanted to or something like that. But this time I did not want to drink. And here I was just fixing to get it done. And there was nothing that I could do about it. I was at the end of my rope. I had absolutely nowhere else to turn except to call Kate. And I called Kate. And, well, I mean, it took a few minutes for her to stop laughing. And she said, you know what, come in here and talk to me. You know, just promise me you're going to come in here and talk to me. You can drink all you want after you talk to me. I promise you I'm going to let you leave, no matter what you decide to do. So I came in, I talked to her, and basically she sat there and laughed at me some more. And stupid. And then she smiled at me and said, I think you're now ready for AA. And I went and attended my first AA meeting that day. And that first meeting was amazing. Big meeting over at Seventh and Irving in a church. And met some young lady who 13-stepped me, and I'm just like, yeah, I'm married. trying to behave myself these days, thank you. There was a bum out on the street. I'll never forget this. There's this bum out on the street who is panhandling on the way in the meeting. And he comes in the meeting, and, you know, no real surprise there. I mean, because there's food and there's coffee there. And so, of course, the man needs to eat and drink some coffee and all that. And it's a chip meeting. So they're giving out chips, chip, 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 chip. And 20 years. Who's got 20 years? And who should raise his hand? Yes. Come skipping down the aisle there, and he picks up his 20-year chip and waves at everybody. And out he goes. And the young lady standing next to me says, well, you know, he can't possibly have 20 years of sobriety. And that's the first time that something happened. And I looked at her and said, well, somebody did. So it's all okay. So other things that happened. So I wound up finding a group in San Francisco that's now since been disbanded called St. Francis Men's. It was only listed as men's meeting in the schedule because they had this rule against religious names. But we were the St. Francis Men's. A bunch of old-timers. Let me talk to you about the steps because the steps helped me. Step 5. Tough one. Go and talk to my sponsor who looked like a freaking Marine. And is as straight-laced as it gets. And, you know, a million years of sobriety, he was only 20-nothing. He was literally sober before he was born. That's how good this guy was. And I was going to tell him all my secrets. And guess what? The first 3 pages of my 4-step were all resentments I had against this poor bastard. All the things I hated about him. And, you know, the part about my part, well, I couldn't figure that out, so I left that blank. And so I'm getting on 38 Geary to go talk to this guy. And I'm thinking, I can't do this. I can't tell him this. This is awful. This is really sick crap. And literally God put a guy on that bus that I'd never seen before. I've been living in the neighborhood for 5 years or so. And this guy looked just like me, 20 years older. Yeah, heavy around the middle, balding, but literally my same face, my same build and everything else. He was stinking drunk. He was harassing the young ladies who were getting on the bus. He was pissing off the bus driver because he didn't have a spare, but he didn't want to get off the bus. And I had one of those moments. I realized that was me. That was me if I did not get on the bus and do that 5th step. And I did that 5th step, and my sponsor sat there and laughed at me, which, you know, people tend to laugh at me a lot in sobriety. It pisses me off sometimes because it's serious. But we got through it. Big lesson I learned on the 9th step. A guy in one of my favorite bars that stole $5 from way back when. And so I happened to be walking by, you know, I was sober maybe 8-9 years, and he was still sitting on that same stool in that same bar, and I walked into the bar. And I looked at him and said, you know, I think his name was Nick or something. And I said, Nick, I'm Sam. Do you remember me? And he's like, oh, yeah, I remember you. Hey, how you doing, buddy? Blah, blah, blah. And I said, great. You know, I stole $5 from you. Do you remember when you were all upset about that $5 that you thought you had and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I was sitting next to you. I stole that and I bought a drink with it. And here it is. And he looks at me and says, I don't remember that at all. Okay, lesson about amends, right? We do amends to help ourselves, okay? This poor guy had forgotten about that $5. I had carried that pain with me for 9 years that ate at me. And I finally got relief. boy, did I make those amends in earnest. Whatever I had left over after that, I made in earnest at that point because I wanted to feel that good again. Some things, big book. Some of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Rigorous honesty. What that means for me today, and what it's like, what that means for today is rigorously honest with myself. I'm constantly asking myself, what am I doing and why am I doing it? I was with a law firm for 8 years and left them and opened up my own little solo practice 6 months ago. My amends to the profession. I'm now a solo practitioner again, behaving honestly, behaving in an upstanding way with integrity, with money, with clients, and with my obligations to the courts. And I'm wildly successful. But there are mornings when I get up because I have a home office and I look at that computer screen and I think to myself, I've got this pile of work that I have to do here. But I've got a computer. There's this pornography that I could look at as well. I think I'd rather do that. Now, rigorous honesty. What am I doing? Why am I doing it? I'm looking at naked women on the computer screen. Why am I doing that? Well, maybe, probably, I think very little of myself. Maybe, probably, my self-esteem is low. You know, I don't think I can do this work. I don't think I'm smart enough to get this done. I think that prosecutor on the other end, because I do state bar defense now, ironically enough, is better equipped than I am, and I'm feeling insecure. And when I've got a pretty unclothed woman smiling at me on the other end of that computer screen, I feel pretty hot, you know? And so I'm thinking to myself, okay, I'm a little honest with myself. That's what I'm going through. Now, sometimes I leave that girl on the screen on nonetheless. But more often than not, I don't, okay? You know, maybe I'm going to go to the corner store and I'm going to buy a bag of Cheetos and eat them. Why am I going to do that? Well, you know, maybe I'm feeling a little insecure. You know, maybe I just want to stuff a bunch of crap in my mouth and forget about what I've got to deal with. Okay, you know, now I can deal with it. Rigorous honesty is rigorous honesty with myself. Sounds like a cop-out. It's not. I'll tell you why. I've had to do a lot of work with my family. Before I go with that, though, I did a little talk over at the School of Law in Berkeley several years back about alcoholism and all that, and I had this punk kid in the room raise his hand and says, you know, Bellacini, I don't want to turn out like you. Okay, I don't want to go through what you went through. So, hey, you know, I still party with my friends. How do I know when I'm turning that corner? Okay? What's the last exit? And I had to think about that a minute, and I realized when I was drinking, I'd lie to people. I lied to people all the time, and I knew I was lying to you. There came a point, though, where I started believing my own bullshit, where I literally, honestly would make up a version of reality in my head that I believed and pawn that off to you so that I could get money or booze or cigarettes out of you. Rigorously honest with myself. I literally have childhood memories, work with my family. I literally have childhood memories that never happened. Never happened. And you can't imagine the look of despair on your parents' face when you talk to them about stuff that you think you did with them, you know, places you went. You know, and they have to look at you and go, no, son, that never happened. I mean, I don't think they would fuck with me over that, but I think it's my problem. So rigorous honesty with myself is the most important thing. As long as I'm doing that, I got a shot at getting through the day sober. The part of the big book that I disagree with, it says we thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we can't. I'm going to close with this. That's wrong. This is the easier, softer way. I will prove it to you. Right now, I charge $360 an hour as a lawyer, and I get paid. People pay me that much money to work for them for per hour. So my time is literally worth something like $6 a minute. Okay? Keep that in mind. So my low point was when I was living out in the Mission, and I needed $5 a day on top of rent and everything else. $5 a day bought me a package of Montclair cigarettes and a half pint of Royal Gate vodka. And one day I woke up with no cigarettes and no vodka, no job and no money. And so I had to panhandle for 8 hours. I was out on the streets on Mission Boulevard around 16th and Mission, panhandling. And finally, towards the close of that 8 hours, I found on top of this trash can one of these old-timey, you know, desk fans from the 1950s. It was all metal, kind of this blue metal, looked really cool, with that old-timey, you know, electrical cord that looked like it would burn your house down if you plugged it in. And there was an antique store just around the corner. So I took it in there, and the thing barely worked, and the fan turned. And I begged them to give me $5 for it. And they could see how desperate it was, and they gave me $5. So my time was worth, you know, let's round it up to six, okay? $6 in 8 hours. And today, My time is worth $6 in, like, 1 minute. That's an improvement. Okay? That is proof positive that I worked a lot harder to get by when I was drinking than I do now. The other end of it, too, is I don't have to worry about what I'm doing. I don't have to worry about who I've lied to, who I've cheated, who I'm running into on the street. I sleep well at night. I will close with this. You know, everything's been running on all light cylinders lately, and then I hit a bump in the road. My 18-year-old boy just last week got diagnosed with something called Alport syndrome, which is a genetic disorder. It can't be cured, which destroys protein that your kidneys need to function. It also accounts for the fact that, you know, he started wearing hearing aids when he was in middle school. It also ruins your ears, the same protein. You know, your ears need that for some reason. I don't get it. I'm a lawyer. I'm a doctor. If I were smart, I would have gone to medical school. But he's going to need a new kidney inside of 10 years, and he may go deaf. And there's not much we can do about it. And as a parent, you know, I got it. You know, if I was still drinking, you know, I would not be there for him. I would think, oh, great, this is an excuse for me to go out and get loaded. But today I'm there for him, and I'm his support. And that's wonderful. And I think I'm about that time. So, you know, I'm really glad to be here. Thank you, thank you, thank you for having me.